Welcome to the History of Networking, where we drag all the skeletons out of the wiring closet and ponder the ghosts of protocols past. So grab a pile of cookies, settle in, and listen as we meld with the finest minds in networking.
Well, hello, Donald. You are still at home today with your guitars on the wall.
I am.
Awesome. In today's episode, we welcome Keith Mitchell to the History of Networking to talk about, well, the history of links and IXs in Europe or whatever he throws out there that Donald and I can ask questions about.
Hi, Russ. Hi, Donald.
So I guess just begin from the beginning. Keith, I mean, where would you like to start? You want to start with a little bit of personal history about getting into networking? Most of us fell into this rather than choosing it, so.
Yeah. No, I think the place I'd like to start was when I was a postgrad at University College London in 1986, which was the first non-military internet site in the UK. And while I was there, I was lucky enough to be taught one-on-one by Peter Kirstein. Who recently passed away. And I mean, Peter was an amazing guy. And he certainly pretty much inspired the course that he did, the MSc course that I was on that he set up, basically has set me up for my entire career. I also happened to meet my wife when I was at UCL as well. So it was kind of an important year. Did a couple of sort of proto-internet things in between then and now. It was when I was at Pipex, which was the UK's first commercial internet provider, which was set up in 92. After we'd been doing that for a couple of years, we kind of became focused on the fact that it was costing a lot of money to get not very much bandwidth across the Atlantic. And there were other internet providers in the UK. And we could see in various other countries and locations in the US, there was commercial internet exchange in May East and May West. In Europe, in Paris and Stockholm, there were internet, and in Amsterdam, there were internet exchanges that were being run on an academic basis. So at around 1994, the five main internet providers in the UK all had kind of ad hoc bilateral arrangements. You know, back in these days, you'd be peering over a 64K leased line. Yeah, the exact product that BT finally ceased on Tuesday. So there was Pipex that I worked for, there was Daemon that you've probably heard of, UKNet, which became EUNet, and then eventually PSI UK, Janet, the academic network. And then the fifth player came along, which was the £500 gorilla British Telecom. And at that point, we kind of thought, maybe it would be a good idea to actually have an internet exchange. But right back then, we actually did a couple of things that were different from other organizations. We didn't just sort of freeload off the local university. We decided that we would set up independently, and that instead of putting it in an academic site, we'd put it in a commercial colocation site, and that was Telehouse, which had a neutral business model. I mean, back then it was a kind of joint venture between KDD and BT. It was built as a disaster recovery center for the City of London and London Docklands. One of the interesting things about it is that the Greenwich Meridian line goes right through the building. We can talk a little bit more about Greenwich time and the links later on. But essentially what we did is we got these six organizations together. The decision to locate it in Telehouse was kind of key because it meant that there was no party who was an internet provider with a vested interest in it. But the other thing I think we did was really important is we built the infrastructure first. We didn't get stuck into a whole lot of debate about what is the best organization structure or who owns this or who gets to control this. It was a case of let's all work together. Let's put some money in the kitty, get a rack in Telehouse, stick a 10 megabit dumb Ethernet hub in it, and then everyone put a router in, we had an internet exchange going.
So let's back up a second, because I think it might be important just to talk about why you said it was very expensive, but I know that in other cases we've talked to people about, it has been very important to reduce the delay and jitter, because all the traffic was being dragged across the Atlantic, right?
Yeah.
There was just no place to put it other than carrying it. Like, there was no, these peering points weren't connected any place but other than through North America, basically, pretty much. Is that?
Yeah. Correct? I mean, typically, back then we found that about a third of our traffic could be offloaded domestically. The latency wasn't such a big deal back then, because these were the days of most of your internet access was FTP and Usenet and a little bit of Telnet. It's not like we were doing media stuff or playing back audio or video. I mean, that with the 64K pipes just couldn't take it back then. So latency was certainly helpful, particularly for people who were doing telnet sessions. But it was a kind of side benefit. The main benefit was the bandwidth reduction and the cost, you know, bandwidth utilization reduction and the cost reduction.
So you started out this process of doing this in Telia, you said, is that correct? Or who was
Telehouse.
It? Telehouse. Okay. So yeah, keep going from there and tell us, you know, more about how that process worked or what was going on there.
We kind of stumbled. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, there was a lot of things that we did with hindsight that we did right, but we were kind of making up in it. As we went along at the time. So we didn't necessarily realize the deeper implications. Up until Telehouse, the links being located in Telehouse, the model was typically that internet exchanges were either hosted in data centers which were owned by carriers or were owned by academic networks. And the problem with them being located in academic networks is you didn't necessarily get 24/7 access. There were potentially issues with scaling that up and lots of internet providers coming in. There were potentially also, and we could see this in other countries where the internet exchange was being set up and then it was being captured by the PTT back in the days before there was very much competition in the telecoms market.
PTT? What's that?
The incumbent carrier. So it's a European term for what was the former state actor. So it was kind of interesting. We kind of went along for about a year with the original cabal of five, and then other internet providers started getting involved, and they were kind of coming to us and saying, "Well, how do we connect to this thing?" And then we realized that we actually need to do some governance. We needed some rules about who could connect. We had to create a legal entity. I found myself a company director and eventually chair of the organization. And that went on for about a year. In the meantime, we upgraded the thing from a 10 meg hub to an actual Ethernet switch. That Ethernet switch was a Cisco Catalyst 1200, which now sits in the Science Museum in London. Cisco weren't too keen on any of their gear being in a museum, but I have been to see it. And then we started adding members. And after about 2 years of that, we ran into a scaling challenge, which was that there's only so much you can do on a volunteer basis when you're running an internet exchange. Once you get beyond a certain size, you need somebody to be responsible. You can't sack volunteers if they do their job wrong. Around that time, we sold PipeX to UUnet. UUnet was then in turn sold to MFS, which was then in turn sold to WorldCom. That gave me a career opportunity to get out of PipeX. And I actually finished up in 96 becoming the first full-time employee of any internet exchange anywhere. And I didn't quite, I thought this would be a nice little thing that would be less hard work than working for an internet provider. But the thing scaled up very, very rapidly. I think we got to about 100 members within 2 or 3 years. I found myself opening an office, hiring a team. And the other thing that happened around then was the sort of one of these waves of moral panic about internet content. And although we had decided that we were, the Links was an infrastructure organization, the powers that be decided that they didn't have access to the right people in the industry, and we kind of get dragged into doing public policy work to deal with problems like child pornography on the internet. And we got involved in setting up what has become the Internet Watch Foundation, and then suddenly all our members said, "Hang on a minute, why are you doing this public policy stuff?" And we kind of had to walk back a bit and realize that, yeah, actually we can do public policy stuff in addition to the Internet Service Providers Association, but we need some kind of framework to contain that. So that was kind of the start of Links being not just an infrastructure operator, but also being an organization that was a player in the public benefit space. And while all this was going on, we're still scaling up the network. Around 1999, I think we were the biggest internet exchange by traffic in the world outside of the US. We were the first to run 100 meg ports to the members, and then we're the first, I believe, to run 1 gig ports to the members as well. Although there were some interesting challenges after a not great experiment with FDDI at the core, we eventually upgraded everything to 1 gig. We also ran into the issue where Telehouse was not the only player in the data center market. There were concerns that this one building in London Docklands was a single point of failure, that they were starting to become a bit of a monopoly. So it was, I pushed quite hard for the Links to become a multi-site internet exchange. And there was a lot of pushback against that from our members who were carriers because they felt that the business of, you know, you're supposed to be neutral, now you're saying that you want to get into business of moving packets between buildings, not just within a building. And with hindsight, that seems kind of obvious, but it was a really controversial idea at the time. We got it through mainly by, you know, making it clear that this is only peering traffic. It's not traffic it's not for people to use on their internal networks. It's not for people to use to buy and sell services over. Again, I think that we were one of the first internet exchanges to go multi-site. We then basically extended our principle of neutrality. We'd set the governance up with a number of key points. Neutrality, a nonprofit entity, a membership organization. And these have been principles that have been used for a lot of internet organizations since then. All the UK organizations that like links, like Nominet, ISPA, were kind of set up along similar principles. Internet Watch Foundation were similar principles at the time. But the neutrality was with regard to our members. We treated internet providers the same. We didn't discriminate between them. We didn't cut special deals with one that we didn't make available to the other. But we then came up with the principle of, if we're going to work with multiple data centers, then we should be neutral towards the data centers as well. We should have a set of principles where we are basically dealing with all the data center operators on the same fair basis, and same equitable basis. You know, if you look at the development of internet exchanges in Europe compared to North America, that data center neutrality has actually, I think, been very key to why there is much better penetration of neutral internet exchanges in Europe than there has been in the US. And eventually, EuroIX was set up as an organization to coordinate all European internet exchanges and extend that.
So can you back up just a second and explain mm-hmm. a little bit about the neutrality you're talking about? Because a lot of people may not realize or understand exactly what you're saying when you say it's a neutral, like it's data center neutrality. What does that mean for people who are, you know, not familiar with it?
Yeah, I think the important principle here is that when you're running an internet exchange, it is a very key resource. It makes a lot more sense for there to be one internet there's a lot less value in having two competing internet exchanges than there is in one. Because when you go to the single internet exchange, that's where you find everybody. If you have had to start deciding, well, I'm going to multiple internet exchanges in order to peer with everybody, then the economics of the internet exchange are not as successful. So that means that the internet exchange becomes a kind of de facto monopoly, and it's at risk of capture by vested interest. And again, you can see this in other countries where the internet exchange is operated by the telco, and the internet providers who are trying to offer internet services in competition with the monopoly telco will find themselves discriminated against. You know, it's like, well, if you're coming to the non-neutral internet exchange building, then you have to pay extra for your special circuits to the internet exchange. And things like that happen. Monopoly players were trying to uphold that and to leverage the dominant market position. The principle of neutrality is that the internet exchange does not gauge in practices which treat some internet providers different from the others. It treats all the internet exchange operators the same. It treats all the data center operators the same. And we kind of come up with a set of neutrality principles in terms of, you treat everybody equally. If we make a service or price available to one, you make it available to all. We also found that transparency is a very important principle when you're running these kind of nonprofit membership organizations that run critical infrastructure as well. It's much better to tell everybody about everything you're doing, rather than having somebody come along and say, well, you didn't tell me about that and I don't agree with that decision.
So basically you just mean that if you, by capture, you mean the internet exchange is purchased by a for-profit company,
yeah.
which makes it not necessarily as useful, but then you get in the situation where people say, well, I want this circuit, and they say, well, that competes with my service, so I'm just not going to give you that, or I'm going to give it to you at a very high rate so that discouraged.
Or if you want to come and peer with the other internet providers, we have to buy transit from B as well.
So that's like helpful for people who may not understand what you mean when you say capture.
Okay.
That's cool. Good.
When you came up with these principles, did they affect how you designed your network?
Not heavily. One of the things that helped us a lot was that in the mid late 1990s, there was an explosion of dark fiber providers in London. Things had just been deregulated. There was all the dot-com money coming in. So it meant that it was between the various key data centers in London, it was very easy to get dark fiber. And I don't just mean like leased dark fiber. I mean actually being able to buy irrevocable right of use on the fiber, you know, effectively a permanent lease. So that meant that we could have just as much bandwidth between the, you know, how much bandwidth we could have between the buildings was basically the state of the art of Ethernet technology. So it rapidly cranked up from 100 meg to 1 gig to 10 gig. So that made it a lot of the network decisions very easy. We just decided the whole damn thing is native Ethernet as fast as it can go. Obviously, being able to go to multiple different buildings gave us a lot more network resilience, and it encouraged the members to have more than one connection. But ultimately, we ran up against the limitation where even the fastest you could run over dark fiber over Ethernet, Ethernet over dark fiber was still a lot slower than the backplane speed of a switch. This was more of an engineering challenge in my time after the links than while I was actually there. But increasingly, the way to do the inter-switch and the inter-site links was you had to do what used to be called a milking machine. You would have lots of parallel channels, which leads to interesting issues with queuing and traffic sharing, load balancing, which are difficult enough with IP, but are even more painful at layer two, which is, you know, the architecture that we had for the Internet Exchange. It was one big layer two medium, and there were certainly challenges with the usual layer two broadcast storm issues, particularly when we had some of the more naive members connect. we also had an interesting issue where one of our less scrupulous members decided that they would connect to Lynx and to May West, but they basically pretended to have transatlantic capacity. And what they did is they actually tunneled traffic between the two internet exchanges, stealing the bandwidth of three of the biggest members. So that was kind of interesting. We figured out what was going on because one of our members was cutting edge enough to be running flow analysis, which was, you know, not something that everybody did back in the late 90s. Yeah, we kicked them out and reported them to the police for criminal theft of bandwidth. Unfortunately, there was a competing internet exchange running in their rack that they hadn't paid for. And all the people on that who were smaller, who were ISPs that were too small to qualify for Lynx membership, because there was this ridiculous set of rules that the Lynx had about who could join and who could not join. Basically, when that happened to them, they thought, you know, we need to do this properly. So they went off and set up another internet exchange in London, which eventually became LunApp, which is, again, an extremely successful and well-run internet exchange. So, you know, at that point, around 2000, we were in the situation where there were actually multiple competing internet exchanges, even in London. And I went off to form a third one, but that's a separate story, which is kind of covered in my Great British Internet Exchange Failures presentation at UKNOF 32. I don't even want to talk too much about the post-Y2K stuff. The other interesting thing that happened during the year 1999 was that everyone was starting to panic about, oh my God, the entire planet's going to collapse at the 31st of December 1999. We need to put a lot of contingency in for making sure that the internet doesn't collapse. And we were considered critical infrastructure in the UK, so we got sucked into all kinds of elaborate schemes, which with hindsight were probably too paranoid. On the other hand, nothing went wrong. Well, I say nothing went wrong. The one thing that did happen is we ran a conference call over the midnight GMT rollover, and we started that call at 11:30 on the 31st, and we finished it at 12:30 on the 1st. And I never got the bill from the teleconference operator for the second half of that call. That is the only Y2K bug I ever had firsthand experience of.
That's a great bug.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we could have kept that conference going forever for free. But the other thing that happened is that there was a scheme to celebrate Greenwich Mean Time, which became Greenwich Network Time. We'd managed to get some funding for three atomic clocks so that people could actually get their Greenwich network time, which was just UTC, but at the links, because you know, you were talking about latency stuff. By the time we get to the year 2000, the latency is a much bigger deal. If you've got low latency in internet exchange, it's a great place to run NTP time synchronization from. So yeah, we had some fun with the atomic clocks, and being on the Greenwich Meridian line generated quite a lot of press and political interest.
Did that help grow, or did that, was that just like randomly didn't really make much difference in the way things went from there?
It didn't make a lot of difference. The thing that was happening in the year 2000 was that because of all the dot-com mania, there was a lot of people who were investing in data centers. All these players who were investing in data centers were saying, well, your internet exchange must come to us. And, you know, we're this organization of maybe 20 people, and suddenly we're being asked to populate every last data center in London that might or might not come into business with expensive state-of-the-art Ethernet switches. And if you're a non-profit, you can't ask your shareholders for investment to do that. It's not necessarily clear that you can borrow money. So there became a lot of pressure around that time for links to be all things to all players. And that's kind of how I got involved in a ill-advised scheme to try and get some private finance into links in order to scale it up. That didn't go well, but it's interesting that a lot of the things that we were advocating for at the time, things like internet exchanges shouldn't have membership rules. Anybody should just be able to join. You should just be able to have an AS and configure BGP. The idea that you could do, an internet exchange could do private interconnects, you know, point-to-point connections between its members as opposed to running them over the switch fabric or doing that over VLANs. The idea that an internet exchange operator could operate multiple separate internet exchanges in different cities. So you could offer the same service and you're not getting into the long-haul business because your cities are not connected together by the internet exchange, but the same internet exchange operator is operating multiple internet exchanges. The idea that you can be neutral, but you can still be commercial. You don't have to be a not-for-profit in order to be neutral. You just need to make sure you have your neutrality principles built into your business model, and possibly even the idea that you can have the internet exchange as a place where people can buy and sell services like transit, not just peering. These were all the ideas that we pushed in the year 2000 and were kind of pitchfork mobbed off the show for. But if you actually look at most of the successful internet exchanges in the world, a lot of them have been doing that for quite some time now. There was a little bit of being ahead of our time there.
The architecture, was it fairly consistent? I mean, how did can you like give us some idea of architecturally how this worked or through the ages changed? You said you were just a simple layer 2 domain at first. But how did that evolve over time and why?
Yeah, the first exchange was literally a dumb Ethernet hub. It wasn't even a switch. And then we put in a Cisco Catalyst 1200, which had 12 10 meg Ethernet ports on it. And then we put a second one in where you connect these two together with 100 meg FDDI. And then we added a third switch, which was a Catalyst 5000. So it had multiple blades in it that could support 100 meg ports. We had some not too successful experiments with FDDI until Gigabit Ethernet came along. When Gigabit Ethernet came along, there was a bunch of other players got into the Ethernet switch market, specifically Extreme and Foundry. And at that point, we decided a good architecture was actually to run, because we're suffering from things like layer 2 broadcast storms, we decided it was a good idea to actually run two separate layer 2 switch architectures. So one was Extreme, one was Foundry. They were not connected together in any way, but we recommended that all our members, if they had a router, that they connected one port on the router to each of the two switch fabrics. We were basically, once we started connecting multiple switches together within a building and multiple sites together within a building, we were kind of using good old-fashioned spanning tree. And until we just decided that it caused so much pain that we actually basically thought it was easier to disable spanning tree and build the redundancy into the topology, but should a link go down, which almost never happened, then we would basically manually enable it. Things have come quite a long way. I remember there was a project in the RIPES EIX working group, European Internet Exchange working group, it was a very long list of features that we wanted from Ethernet switch vendors because we were sick of all this layer 2 crap. Things like being able to we had rules where members could only connect routers, but there was always a member who thought they could save money by connecting a switch. And as soon as they connected their switch to our switch, usually bad things happened. And you know, and this is subsequently been addressed by you know, very different architectures that have come in as layer two, and you know, it started with MPLS, and I don't mean technically current with all the things that can be done with Ethernet these days. There was a fairly straightforward transition from gig to 10 gig. Again, that was, you know, we'd run 10 gig links at the core and 1 gig connections to members, and that is pretty much continued. You know, in the time set since then, it's scaled up from 1 gig to 10 gig to 100 gig. But there's I don't envy the people that run internet exchanges these days. They have some very interesting technical challenges in terms of traffic management and availability. And we did one or two other things. We had route servers. We were also involved in setting up the first European root name server. So Kroot was operated by Ripe NCC, and they built their first instance of that at Lynx because it made a lot of sense to have a root server at an internet exchange. And I remember Daniel Karenberg brought the first server over in a short hot flight from Amsterdam to London City, and basically carried all the gear in a black taxi. London Black's taxi
So that predates NetNode, for instance?
No. I think they were kind of around the same time. I can't remember exactly.
Okay. The I was just curious because, we had talked to some folks about NetNode, so I was just trying to figure out how those might lay out together. So I could.
Yeah, I think we did that probably in late 96 or early 97, if I recall correctly.
Okay, that's interesting. So basically, the architecture went from being one big switch to being a switch with blades, so you had different connections for different customers, to a full-on. Now, today, are people using primarily just, a fabric, or are they... are they using like a layer three with a layer two overlay, or have things advanced beyond that, or is this just more, it's pretty much the way it's always been?
It's been some time since I worked in the internet exchange space. My understanding of what Lynx is doing now is that it's presented as a layer two service at the edge, but basically they're using Juniper technology to encapsulate the layer two stuff in a layer three core.
Talk to us a little bit about the route server and what role that plays, so that people kind of understand a little bit about the whole route server game and how important that is maybe in the world of IXs.
Route servers are useful because they're basically a place where, instead of having to manage lots of peerings with everybody in the exchange, you can manage one peering with the route server, and it will give you the routes for everybody on the exchange who's peering with that. Again, since my time at Lynx, there have been a lot of really quite sophisticated route server implementations where you can do things like multiple views, and you can do selective sharing of which prefixes. Back in the Lynx days, the route server was a Cisco, I can't remember the model number, but it was basically a router with about 2U in size that had maybe 400 meg interfaces on it. So we had a single view. Peering with the route server was not mandatory. A lot of internet exchanges, peering with the route server was mandatory, and this had the effect of deterring the larger players who didn't want to peer with everybody. So we made it optional to peer with the route server. And if you connected to peer with the route server, then you got the same view as everybody else who peered with the route server. There wasn't anything more sophisticated than that. We did operate another thing we called the collector router. And what the collector, peering with the collector router was mandatory, but it didn't cause, it only accumulated. It was basically a set of routes, which were the all the prefixes that were directly available by peering at the exchange. And what we did with that is we put Lynx's own infrastructure behind that so that we could manage the network and have good connectivity to all our members. And that is where we put things like root servers, top-level name servers for .UK, so that they had good, and the time servers, so that they had good connectivity to all our members. Basically, we had two things. We had a collector router, which was all the prefixes that you could see at the exchange for internal use only. And then we had the route server, which was all the prefixes that people were prepared to share with everybody else on an equitable basis at the exchange. And the other thing about route servers is that anybody who gets all their peering from a route server is probably asking for trouble, because then the route server becomes a big single point of failure. And in general, the practice at the time was you have direct peering relationships with the major players, the people who are critical to your business, and then all the other people who are maybe smaller players, and it's nice to have, but it's not critical to your business. If you lose your peering with them, you get via the route server, and that way people would scale the number of prefix, the number of peerings that they had to manage.
I guess from that point forward, links just continue to grow, and I think you've stepped out of that role and are doing other things now, but links just continue to grow and be a force in the London area for people to peer with and stuff like that, and
they operate exchanges in Manchester, Scotland, and Cardiff and Wales as well.
Okay.
So they have the multiple, and I believe they have partnerships with other exchange operators in other countries as well.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, they have a internet exchange in the Virginia area, Nova.
Thanks for coming on then, Keith, and we'll wrap it
pleasure.
Up. And I'll let you know. I'll try to remember to let you know when this publishes. Now, are you working on current stuff in this space or another space that people might want to know about, so that, you know, like it's worth pointing them at a web page or something that you're doing?
The main thing I'm doing at the moment is running another neutral not-for-profit membership organization, but it for the domain name business. You know, the internet exchange stuff, what I did for Links, I think it's a single thing in my career that I'm most proud of, and you know, we did a lot of stuff in it, and it was fun. But for some reason, the domain name business has kind of, I never sought it out in my career, it's always sought me out. We have about 100 members at DNSORG, and it's all the organizations that run internet namespace, so VeriSign, Newstar, most of the operators, country code operators like Nominate, JPRS, DNIC. We don't operate critical infrastructure, but we're here to improve the understanding and operation of the domain name system. We do that through running workshops. We do that through various community resources like mailing lists and chat rooms. We do that also by gathering live data off of the running DNS from the operators so that it can be shared with the researchers for analysis. And another thing that we do is we do a bunch of open source tools for gathering data off the DNS, measuring, instrumenting, telemetry for test performance testing tools for the DNS as well.
So how did that come about? Because that's pretty interesting too.
Paul Vixie.
Okay.
So yeah, I got involved. I got to know Paul during the days of Commercial Internet Exchange and Palo Alto Internet Exchange. And when we were both working on Internet Exchange stuff, and Links also got involved in a lot of spam prevention issues. So that's how I got to know Paul. You know, when he moved on from Palo Alto Internet Exchange to ISC, he needed somebody to bootstrap this organization, which again wasn't part of ISC, but was neutral and separate. So I started working for DNSORG at ISC, and then we spun it out.
DNSORG is where you can be found now, right?
Yes. Also involved in the UK Network Operators Forum, so I still do British stuff as well, and that's like British NANORG.
Donald, you're just on Twitter, right?
That's me.
That's you. Me, not you, Sharp, right?
Yeah.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks, Keith, for coming on the History of Networking.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.